You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up later, we'll hear from a guest who says it's time to rethink the family farm as the ideal in American agriculture. Now, temperatures are hot for much of Wisconsin today, and the forecast says that by the end of the week, they're just going to get hotter. High temperatures and humidity are bringing us a sticky heat wave this week. Heat indexes in the 90s for a lot of Wisconsin, maybe in the low hundreds in the southern part of the state. Jonathan Erdman is senior meteorologist at weather.com, based in Milwaukee and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. John, welcome back to the show.
Rob, it's great to be here.
Well, how hot are we going to get this week around the state? Break down some of the numbers for us.
Well, it looks like it's kind of an upward trend here, peaking on Friday and then some relief in the weekend. So it looks like by the time we get to Thursday, looks like high temperatures will be in the low to mid 90s in southern Wisconsin, generally upper 80s to low 90s in northern Wisconsin. And by the time we get to Friday, boy, again, that's going to be the peak of it. We'll see highs mid to upper 90s. Wouldn't be shocked if a few locations in southern Wisconsin push near 100 degrees on Friday. And in northern Wisconsin, it'll definitely be in the upper 80s to low 90s. So, yeah, a couple of hot days coming up.
I know this is the time of year when we can see these kind of temperatures in the state. What's driving this current trend of hot weather?
Well, Rob, we always have to tell ourselves it is July. So, you know, if we didn't have a heat wave like this, there'd probably be something wrong. There'd probably be some kids that are disappointed not being able to enjoy water parks and everything. But generally what's happening right now is we have some high pressure aloft, a big heat dome, if you will, that builds over the central U.S. And when that happens in July, occasionally that excessive heat builds northward from the corn belt of Nebraska and Kansas and Missouri and Iowa, and eventually it pokes its way on occasion into Wisconsin. And when it does that, we usually have a couple of days of hot weather before we get the next cold front coming through.
As the saying goes, it's not just the heat, it's the smothering moisture that seems like it's drowning you as you walk around. Something like that, I'm paraphrasing. What's up with the high humidity this week?
Well, I hear you. I just got in from doing a lot of yard work this morning, and yeah, I was basically a hot mess. So that's the time of year when we see dew points around 70 degrees. That's usually a good indication that when we spend, you know, a few minutes outside, we start sweating quickly. And that's pretty typical of these midsummer heat waves. It's not just the heat. We get that building humidity that comes northward from the Ohio Valley and the Mid-Mississippi Valley. And with all those cornfields emitting evapotranspirating moisture into the atmosphere, we just can't get heat without humidity this time of year.
At what point does this go from being maybe a nuisance to hazardous?
Well, typically with heat waves, of course, all the attention goes to how hot it will get. But as far as what turns heat waves deadly, it's really how long they last. And the reason being is that those that don't have access to air conditioning, what happens is at night you don't get a lot of relief. So, for instance, during this heat wave, we'll have low temperatures in the morning that really aren't that low. We'll have low temperatures maybe bottoming out around 78 or so in Milwaukee and Madison, maybe mid-70s up toward Green Bay. And when that happens, you don't get much cooling in the evening. It just doesn't, you know, if you blew a fan on you without any air conditioning, you wouldn't feel all that much cooler because it could still be, you know, upper 70s to low 80s. So that's when heat waves turn dangerous, is when they last for several days. And unfortunately, in other parts of the country, that could turn dangerous.
Talking to Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Milwaukee. We're talking about this week's heat and humidity around most of Wisconsin. We hear this phrase, a heat index, John. What does that mean? Does it really affect how we experience the heat?
Yeah, Rob, it's very similar to how we describe wind chill in the winter. So it just gives us a way of communicating how hot it will feel. And the idea is the more humid it is, obviously you sweat more, but you're unable to, you know, your body is cooled by evaporation. So the more humid the air is, the less evaporation of sweat from your body, and you'll just feel hotter. So a heat index is basically a combination of heat and humidity. So the higher the number is, the more dangerous the heat wave is. And so on Friday, for instance, we're looking at heat indices anywhere from 100 to 110 degrees in parts of central and southern Wisconsin. And that is in the danger zone as far as heat waves are concerned.
When we have a lot of heat and a lot of humidity, does that mean there's a lot of energy in the air? Does that put us at risk of a powerful thunderstorm if a front comes through?
Most often in Wisconsin, the answer is yes to that. And so we'll see clusters of thunderstorms the next several days, tonight into Thursday. We may see some Thursday night into Friday. And then finally, what happens this time of year is when you get a cold front coming through, you get thunderstorms with that, and then you get relief behind it. So unfortunately, this weekend, we will see some thunderstorms here and about in parts of Wisconsin. But it's the price you pay for getting heat relief.
Now, let's talk about that relief a little more. You've touched on it a couple times. I want more details to give me something to look forward to. When and how much are we looking to cool down?
Oh, well, I've got some great news. So this, you know, there have been heat waves in Wisconsin in the past where we've gone a week straight with you know, excessive heat and humidity, and it just doesn't seem like a break is ahead. But I can give you some good news that by this weekend, by Saturday, we'll start to see that cooler air start to spread into northern Wisconsin. By Sunday, it should get into southern Wisconsin. Now, again, we're going to have to pay the price for that with thunderstorms. But the great news is that by next week, it absolutely looks fabulous for late July. We'll have high temperatures, maybe around 80 degrees in southern Wisconsin, in the 70s in northern Wisconsin. We'll have lows in the 50s in northern Wisconsin, low 60s in southern Wisconsin. We can give the AC a break. And really, much of next week looks absolutely fabulous here in Wisconsin.
That sounds great. Now, we're seeing reports that if climate change continues as it's been going, it's going to boost the odds of this kind of heat wave. It's something that can happen, of course, anyway, but it gets maybe more likely and more common in the future. What kind of things do you think about when you hear a report like that?
Well, it's certainly, you kind of think of it as you know, weighting the dice. So, you know, in a warming world, we do expect warmer temperatures at night. And that's probably the most pronounced signature we're seeing here in Wisconsin is just warmer nighttime temperatures, especially in the cities where you have that urban heat island in play. So in Milwaukee and in Madison, to a lesser extent in some of the smaller towns. So, you know, this isn't a particularly bad long-lived heat wave by Wisconsin standards. In 2012, for instance, you know, if it makes you feel a little better here, in 2012, we had 10 straight days of 90-degree heat in Madison, and four of those days were triple-digit heat. We're seeing nothing like that with this heat wave. But yes, in general, unfortunately, we can expect longer, long-lived heat waves with especially warmer temperatures at night here in Wisconsin.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com based in Milwaukee. He was with us today to talk about what we can expect out of the heat wave hitting Wisconsin this week. Coming up, a disease affecting Wisconsin snakes has the DNR asking for help from citizen scientists. A DNR reptile expert tells us how you can help. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn more about a threat facing snakes around Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about welcoming pests.
Ever feel like you're constantly battling garden invaders? Dealing with the weeds, bugs, and critters can be a never-ending, daunting task. Or you can roll with it, just like author B.J. Hollers and his family.
My neighbors did the logical thing. Rolled out the chicken wire, planted the stakes, and transformed their garden into a fortress. Sun and rain still had access, though no longer the rabbits or the raccoons or the deer. Much of the garden's beauty was gone, but the crop remained. Sprigs of parsley, carrot greens, summer squash. It was a price my neighbors were willing to pay. Meanwhile, our garden was quite the opposite. Unencumbered, free, and for every critter with whom we shared our neighborhood, a smorgasbord of earthly delights. My wife and I attempted our own deterrent, recruiting a plastic owl who served admirably for all of an hour, at which point the rabbits grew wise to our dead-eyed sentinel, viewing him more as a maitre d' than our tactical defense force. One morning in late May, in the days prior to the invasion, my 5-year-old son stood beside me in the yard and said, rather unceremoniously, "Oh, look, a deer." I turned to spot a fawn half hidden in clover, his snout bobbing like a dousing rod. He lay folded atop a bed of needles, staring at my son as my son stared back. Two creatures too young to be afraid. In retrospect, I should have been the one to be afraid. I now see that fawn for what he was, the opening salvo of the onslaught soon to come, whose presence became so routine that some nights we all dined al fresco. My young family hunched in their lawn chairs, popsicles dangling, while the rabbits and squirrels made short work of everything edible. It was easier to marvel than be mad, and so we did. By mid-July, it was clear we had a problem. Not with the pests, but with our neighbors. While they worked hard to keep the animals away, we worked hard to recruit them. Had we been cable TV subscribers, we might have filled our time otherwise. But since we weren't, we took our front row seats in the lawn chairs, reveling in the animals' displays. Equally curious, the animals watched us too, shooting us looks which, roughly translated, meant, "Have you people never heard of chicken wire?" 6 months later, long after the garden was gone and our plastic owl was neck deep in snow, I peeked out the back window to spot three deer nosing through the hoarfrost. They were more apparition than animal, more guest than pest. I like to think they were a family, and that perhaps the littler one was the one we'd met in the clover the previous spring. That morning, when the deer returned, the world was so cold it could snap. So cold, I swear I saw a shimmer of heat rising from their fur. Long after they'd left me, their hoofprints held firm in the snow. A reminder, not of what we'd lost, but of all we'd been given.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, small bumps under the skin, swollen mouth tissues, scabbing, those are a few of the possible symptoms that can appear in snakes that have a sickness called snake fungal disease. And the Wisconsin DNR is concerned about more snakes in the state becoming infected with it. And they're asking for the public's help in identifying reptiles that may be ill. Rory Pulaski is a conservation biologist at the state DNR. She's in the studio with me now. Rory, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, why are we worried about this particular snake fungal disease?
Yeah, so this is an emerging disease we've been noticing in snakes. It was first documented officially about 2009. And in some populations, it's been completely decimating the snake populations. It's found in the eastern part of the United States primarily. And in some cases, we'll see it affect one or two snakes in a population. In other cases, for example, in Illinois, a really rare snake they have there, the Massasauga rattlesnake, it's almost completely wiped out the population. So it's a big conservation concern for us.
And something that seems weird to me, this affects not just one species of snake, but lots of them.
Yeah, it's not specific to species. We have 21 species of snakes in Wisconsin, and it's been found in 11 of them. So if some of the listeners are familiar with white nose syndrome and bats, it's a little bit of a similar situation to that. It can affect most of the bats. The fungus can affect most of the bats in white nose as well.
Talk about this disease a little more, what it is and how it affects snakes and why it can be fatal to them.
Yeah, it can be fatal to them because typically the way it presents itself in a snake is an increased, you may see a snake that has extra little bumps under the skin, like you had mentioned, unusual kind of scabs on the body. And these are wild animals, so they're going to get, you know, potentially attacked, partially attacked by a predator, and they could have scars. But these are more unusual than that. They're larger. They may be scales that are coming off their body. And in extreme cases, their tissue in their mouth and their jaw can get swollen, which prevents them from eating and drinking, and they eventually just die of dehydration.
Before we get into how the public can help out in spotting this disease, talk about the role of snakes in our ecosystems here in Wisconsin. What are they doing out there?
Yeah, they're, you know, and I try to remind people of this all the time. Snakes are obviously not a fan of everyone, but they play a very important role. They're a food source for a lot of different animals, especially some of our hawks and raptors. And they also prey on a lot of different animals, small mammals, huge, you know, they eat a large number of mice every year. We even have one species of snake in Wisconsin that eats other snakes. So
we are talking about a disease that's affecting snakes around the eastern United States. We're trying to spot it here in Wisconsin now. Rory Pulaski is with us from the state DNR to talk about how you can get involved. So you're reaching out to would-be citizen scientists. What are you hoping people around the state can do?
Yeah, you know, we, myself and my coworkers are out in the field doing research and looking for snakes as well, but we obviously don't have enough staff and time to search everywhere in the state and especially on private properties. So we really can use the public's help. They can kind of be our eyes on the ground and look for snakes and help us look in some of the counties where we haven't recorded or haven't done a lot of surveys yet, and then also look for additional species that may be affected by the disease.
So if I own some property, say, and I know, oh, I see snakes out here sometimes, what should I be doing? Well, how can I be a detective here and get that information to you?
Yeah, so you can just, when you're out, if you see any snakes, keep an eye out for them. You don't even usually have to pick them up. If you have a good zoom camera, you can usually see from a few feet away if they look like they might have any weird lesions or bumps on them. And then a photo and submit it to us. Our email address is dnrherptiles, which is H-E-R-P-T-I-L-E-S at wi.gov. People can submit photos there. We've actually, in the last week or so, had some new counties reported to us by citizens already that have been seeing snakes on their property that are infected.
Can we, on your website, can we find pictures of infected snakes so we know what we're looking for?
Yep, yeah. The easiest way is to go on the DNR website and search for snake fungal disease. There'll be contact information on there and then three different pictures with good examples of kind of what you're looking for.
Supposing people do this, they get you that information, what then do you do with it?
Yeah, for right now, you know, we have a whole group of other people, microbiologists, that are working with us as well, kind of on the fungus side of this. So right now, they're looking at, you know, potential cures for the fungus, for the infections. We're trying to best document the species and the locations right now, and then monitor individual snakes and populations to see how they're responding.
Now, as I understand white nose syndrome for bats, it isn't necessarily just that this one illness in and of itself is hurting the bat populations, but it might be a symptom of other causes of ill health. It might be working in conjunction with other things to reduce bat populations. Could we be seeing something similar then with snakes elsewhere in the U.S., maybe here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's very similar in that sense, in that the fungus itself doesn't seem to be killing the animals. It's just when it infects the snake, especially when it gets to that soft tissue in their mouth, they can't eat and drink as well. Also, if they have a large number of lesions or bumps on their skin, they shed their skin when they grow, and they try to shed their skin to get those lesions off. And when they do that, they may be perching in more obvious places, basking in the sun, so they could be more susceptible to predators.
Apart from the disease itself, how are snake populations doing here in the state?
They're pretty steady. You know, we have there's definitely an issue with some of them. With, you know, we have a lot of habitat fragmentation and roads in the state, but they seem to be holding their own. We have a couple of fairly rare species. One is the eastern Massasauga rattlesnake, and that was federally listed about 2.5 years ago. So we're in particular paying attention to those really rare species.
Speaking of rattlesnakes, if I'm out there looking to take close up pictures of snakes, are there a few in the state that I should maybe try to zoom in from a distance?
Yes, definitely the two rattlesnakes. I would not recommend holding those. And one of them is our really rare one, is so rare it's hard for us to even find them. So yeah, if you have any question, if you see a snake, if you're not sure if it's venomous, take a picture from a distance. I also like to let people know that snake fungal disease is not something humans can get. It's possible we could be carriers. It's thought that the fungus is in the soil. So we want to make sure people are, you know, washing off, disinfecting if possible, their shoes if they're in an area, but holding the snake won't cause any harm to people.
this is a citizen science effort. You're trying to get people involved in helping spot these snakes and this disease. And we've talked to other DNR officials and others around the state about citizen science projects. Do you think we're tapping now into this largely untapped resource that we have?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I work a lot with amphibians and reptiles, and we have a lot of good frog projects going on, and they're a little bit more cute and cuddly to people. And we really don't have a science or a citizen science project for snakes. And I think this is one way that the public can really help us with this. You know, it could be you don't even have to go out of your way to look for snakes. But if you happen to be, you know, even on a sidewalk, see a garter snake passing by, if you can just keep an extra eye out and see if you see anything unusual, snap a picture with your cell phone and send it in if it looks like it has something.
Is it more challenging to be a conservation biologist working with snakes, which tend to not want to be seen, as opposed to, you know, a big mammal like deer or bear or something?
Yeah, I mean, they both have their challenges. So, but it's, you know, we definitely have to have perfect weather conditions when we go out. They can be pretty challenging to find.
And is the hope ultimately to say, okay, Wisconsin, we're not going to see this disease spread as fast as it did in some other states?
Yeah, I mean, that would definitely be our hope. You know, unfortunately, I think the microbiologists still don't know a lot about the pathways for this disease and why in some populations we have some snakes that are, you know, populations that are just decimated and some where it only affects an individual or two. Luckily, so far in Wisconsin, we've only found it in a snake or two typically in a population. It doesn't seem to be quite as widespread, but we really don't know that information. So the best thing we can do right now is just to try to get a handle on species and counties that it's found in.
So this citizen information, these photos could help track how and where this spreads.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Rory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rory Pulaski. She's a conservation biologist at the state DNR. We talked about the threat of snake fungal disease. We've got a link up at WPR.org explaining more about the disease and how to report it if you've seen a snake with signs of it. Coming up, American culture has always had a special place in its heart for the family farm. But an agriculture expert says the family farm has, in most cases, not worked very well as an economic model. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Now, when you think of the ideal farming operation in the United States, there's a good chance your mind conjures up thoughts and images of a family farm. Since the dawn of the United States, the family farm has been seen as an ideal of American agriculture, even as many of those farms go under. Our next guest says it's time to rethink that ideal. She says putting family farming on a pedestal tends to ignore some of the harsh realities about the practice. And she says if we're serious about building sustainable and robust food systems, it's time to reconsider how farming has been done for most of human history collaboratively. Sarah Tabor has worked in agriculture, food, and manufacturing for over 20 years. She started out on field and factory crews, then moved up to soil and veterinary diagnostics. Tabor has a doctor of plant medicine from the University of Florida, which is equivalent to a veterinarian for crops. She's the producer and host of the Farm to Tabor podcast. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. How's it going?
Good. Well, how did this idea of the family farm as the ideal farm come about in the United States?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of history behind it. I'm not sure how far back you want to go.
as far as you want.
It was more or less kind of done to, I guess the really impolite way to say it is it was basically a garbage disposal for poor people. They were like, hey, we don't want to build our economy to make sure there's actually jobs for everybody. That's not how it worked. Let's just throw people at the frontiers, you know, at the borders. Let's let poor people get shot at by the Indians. And then, you know, rich people would move in and kind of, you know, often these are squatters a lot of the time. The Homestead Act actually came pretty late in U.S. history. So when we think like kind of the orderly homesteading thing, that was a lot later. And by the time that came along, it was kind of in marginal environments like the Great Plains, the Southwest, that weren't actually great for farming. So a lot of the homesteading and the family farming that happened in the U.S. was really just kind of a way to kind of, you know, not have to worry about what happens with poor people in our country. Let's let them just try and farm and we'll see how it goes. some people did get very lucky and they did kind of manage to make a living. At the same time, a whole lot of people didn't. There was a lot of disease, a lot of isolation, a lot of injuries, and you'll still see that happening with family operations today because of the nature of them. They're kind of smaller. They have low margins. So you have people drowning in manure pits and, you know, just getting crushed by machinery and those kinds of things because they don't have the time or the resources to really kind of to have the kind of safety you'd want to have in an industrial environment. And so working with farmers, you know, I just kind of started thinking like, hey, everybody knows that this sucks. why don't we think a little harder about this and kind of why it sucks this bad? And as soon as I started looking into the history of it, I went, oh, well, we've always kind of been, I guess, kind of telling ourselves this fairy tale about how it's always been great. And that's never really been the case. A few people did become very lucky, but for the majority of people, it hasn't been that great an experience. So we should be able to talk about that. We should talk about, hey, this hasn't been good to us. Maybe let's try some other options.
We hear recently threats to family farms in the United States, so here in Wisconsin, dairy farms in particular with low milk prices. But as you look back in a piece you recently wrote, we've always been talking about these threats. So whether it's the Dust Bowl era in the 1930s or the 1800s, the family farm has always been this kind of precarious economic outfit.
Right. So kind of by its very nature, you know, the difference between a good year and a bad year is very thin, right? So what would happen historically, and this is both in the early U.S. and then also in, I think ancient Rome was really the first place family farming was really widespread. You would have this process called differentiation so that you're kind of on a knife's edge between, you know, poverty and actually doing well. The margins are very thin. So if you have a good year or if you have a good plot of land, then you're going to do a little bit better year by year. You can reinvest. You're going to become wealthier over time. And then conversely, if you have a couple of bad years in a row, or if you just have a bad plot of land, or if you have, you know, if you're not able to produce heirs or you produce too many heirs and you have to subdivide it, you're going to get poorer and poorer and poorer. You're very vulnerable to all those things. So when you have a cluster of people like a farming village or something like that, where some people are always getting a little bit richer and some people are always getting a little bit poorer, that's actually very common anytime family farming has been done in history. So ancient Rome, colonial Americas, to some extent, the late Middle Ages in England, you'll always see rich people getting richer and poor people getting poorer. And I think we kind of really have been sold family farming as this idea of like everybody stays kind of middle class all the time. And that's never how it's actually worked. It always kind of winds up leading basically to feudalism. Some people are always sliding into poverty. They need help for their neighbors. They wind up kind of indebted either straight up in finances or definitely just knowing they're not as good. And they're just needing help and handouts all the time. And then some people are always getting richer. And again, that's something you see over and over and over again. Family farming's not that common in history, but whenever it happens, you see this pattern. And it's not the healthiest thing, and I wish we could talk more about it.
Talking to Sarah Tabor, producer and host of the Farm to Tabor podcast, she recently wrote a piece on family farms and why they may not be the best, the most ideal, the most sustainable ways to produce food. Sarah, you just mentioned three points in history where family farms did pretty well. Ancient Rome.
Oh, no.
Late Middle Ages.
They happened and
right.
They did badly.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. late Middle Ages, colonial America. And in your piece, you point out they had one thing in common. A lot of people died making land really cheap for a little while.
Yeah, the only way for it to really pencil out is if land is basically cheap. So in colonial America, we had just a lot of native people died of smallpox, and then there's all this free land, and you could just go in and basically set up camp, and you're good to go. In the Middle Ages in England, the Black Death wiped out tons and tons of people, and so again, there's all this free and cheap land. And then in ancient Rome, you know, the Roman army would just go take over an area. They'd sell all the inhabitants into slavery to the rich people in ancient Rome. And then parcel out land in small family plots to soldiers. That was kind of like their retirement pension. So the only time you ever really see it happen, it was when land is basically made like it just has no value because there's so much more land than there are people. And that's the only time it's ever really penciled out. And because people have this tendency to reproduce and fill that land back up, that phase never lasts. So again, we have a lot of stories of people who are able to do pretty well for themselves through family farming, but we have to look at the weird situation that it occurred in, which is no longer the case. Like, land is now very expensive. It's very different now.
Well, let's look at a couple different alternatives. One that we see a lot and that people kind of point as to sometimes as the bad guy, as opposed to the family farm, is corporate agriculture, however you want to define that. Do you see that as a preferable mode of producing our food?
So if you read the article, I didn't actually talk about corporate farming as an alternative at all. Mm-hmm. If you look at the corporate farms, if you look at the farms in the U.S., 96% of them are family owned, which means the vast majority of what we're calling quote unquote corporate farms are family owned. They are family farms that just got very big. They're still run by mom and pop. So I think if there's any farm listeners listening, you know, I think a lot of the reason that farms can become very frustrated with activists, you know, quote unquote, is because activists are trying to save family farms by working against what they think is corporate agriculture, which is, you know, things like confinement animal operations, monoculture, things like that. Well, those are practices that family farms use. So family farmers hear these activists talking about how these things are bad, and they're like, wait, I do that. Screw you, activists. And so there's a huge misunderstanding there. And so corporate farming and family farming, people talk about them like they're two ends of a spectrum. They're total opposites. They're actually, by and large, the same thing.
And what you did write about in your piece, though, is a more collaborative approach to farming. What are you pointing toward there?
Yeah, so I didn't really talk about corporate farming as an alternative because I think everybody's pretty familiar with how that works. So a couple models I pulled up, and these are not theoretical. These are not hippy-dippy, you know, let's try this. These are things that people are doing in real life right now, and they work great. So it's basically an employee-owned farm, and there's two big groups of people doing that in the United States right now, and they have been doing it for a very long time. There's Native American groups, and then there's Hutterites, which I don't know if they're Hutterite colonies in Wisconsin. I think the closest ones are in Minnesota. We can talk about whichever one you'd like first, either Native groups or Hutterites.
Yeah, talk about Hutterites, because that was an interesting example that I think is not on a lot of people's radar.
Right. So the Hutterites are an Anabaptist group. So they're kind of, I'd call them Amish adjacent. The Amish shun modern technology, but they still have their own family of farms. So the Hutterites do a little different. They'll use modern technology. They use tractors, you know, all that kind of stuff. But they also will own a farm as a community. It's like a village-sized farm that just everybody helps run together in these groups of 50 to 150 people. And really quick, so like whenever I bring up Hutterites, there's always somebody yelling, but they're bad to women. They're super conservative. And, you know, I just want to point out, number one, I grew up very conservative. There's really nothing about that lifestyle that you can tell me that I don't already know. And then number two, you don't have to live that lifestyle to farm like to use that business model. They really have nothing to do with each other. So I just don't really see that as being a concern, but that's something people always like to bring up. But the way they farm is a lot of family farms, they'll kind of either do grain or they'll do dairy. You kind of have to focus on one thing just because family farms have by nature kind of a smallish number of people. You only have so much bandwidth. Like you may have a lot of labor saving equipment, like big tractors, you know, big equipment, but you still have a limited number of people to operate it, and you still have a limited amount of bandwidth. So what a Hutterite farm will do instead is they grow grain, you know, and they'll grow typically a lot of livestock. They'll do cattle, they'll do dairy, they'll do broilers, turkeys, something like that. And what that lets them do is they diversify and they spread their risk. And this is something we talk about a lot in agriculture is how we should diversify to manage risk, but we don't ever talk about how a family farm doesn't really have enough people to really pull that off. You know, like sometimes you'll find a farm that does grain and broilers, they do grain and dairy or something like that, but that's about as far as you can go. So they're able to spread their risk over all these different commodity categories, and they have enough people to pull that off. They do a lot of their own construction as well. And, you know, again, when you're a solo family operation, you can do a lot of your own work on site, but it's, you know, that jack of all trades thing, right? It takes you a little longer and the results aren't always exactly what you need them to be. You know, you're just a little under-resourced and that's the nature of the thing. And having multiple people on site in these Hutterite communities means some people can really specialize in the mechanics. Some people can really specialize in animal care. And it just lets them get really great results. They have just a great knowledge base on the farm that, again, being a jack of all trades doesn't really let you do. And I think when I say this a lot of times, like people kind of hear it as like judgmental against family farms, and that's not it at all. It's just acknowledging, like family farmers are always telling us, we don't have a lot of resources. We don't have a lot of margins. We're having to do everything ourselves and it sucks. So, you know, if it sucks that bad, we could try something else. That would be okay.
Talking to Sarah Tabor right now about the idealized image of the family farm and the reality. She says, for most part, it's not economically sustainable. Hasn't been for most points in human history. She's worked in agriculture, food, and manufacturing for over 20 years and has a doctorate in plant medicine from the University of Florida. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's time to rethink, maybe reinvent family farms as we know it? Does something need to change if you're a farmer? If you're on a family farm yourself, what do you think? What kind of struggles are you facing? Would you welcome this idea of a more collaborative approach to the business of farming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about family farms and whether the idealized image has ever lined up with the economic realities. Sarah Tabor is our guest. She's written about this, and she's worked at agriculture, food, and manufacturing for over 20 years. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is it time to reconsider the family farm as the ideal in American agriculture? What would a more collaborative approach to farming look like to you if you work on a farm, own a farm yourself? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, that collaborative idea, borrowing ideas from the Hutterites you were just talking about and others, how would much of American agriculture get there from here, from where we are now?
So that's a fantastic question. The way farmers collaborate, so obviously farmers have worked together pretty much ever since there's been farming, right? They do it in different ways. The way a lot of U.S. farmers tend to do it now out in farm country, it's really a little bit more of an emergency thing. Like we got a sandbag, somebody's in trouble, let's go help them out. You know, someone passed away, let's help do some chores. It doesn't tend to be like the normal way of doing things all the time. So it's going to be a little bit different. One thing I would recommend probably not trying is you get a bunch of people who already own their own farm and we're like, okay, guys, let's do it together, because everybody's kind of gotten used to doing it on their own. And, you know, not everything is sometimes there's some trade-offs that's going to take somebody in the shorts, right? So you can't just ask somebody like, hey, let's all work together, but this year you're going to do bad with it. Like, that's not going to allow people to stick together. I think maybe a better approach would be, hey, you know, XYZ land has become available for sale. So let's get together, let's buy it, and let's run it as a company, just like an employee-owned company. So again, just running as a single employee-owned company, I think has some advantages, because if you have a, you know, say, bad example here, but you're trading off, say, wheat acreage and corn acreage, and you have, say, somebody who's in charge of wheat. Again, this is a very bad example, but if you tell the wheat guy, hey, we're not going to do as much wheat this year because of price issues or something like that, well, he just loses out. But if everybody owns a piece of the company in total, that means that as long as the whole thing does better, even if my department, you know, like if I'm doing grain or if I'm doing, you know, dairy or if I'm doing eggs or something, even if my department shrinks that year to allow us to do a little bit more of something else, I'm still better off in total. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. And the diversifying you write about is kind of key to all of this, so that whatever this group of farmers looks like or is incorporated as, they don't sink or swim based on the price of one or two commodities. Is that right?
Yeah, that's really key. And something that you'll see kind of a lot in the sustainable agriculture discourse, which I'm not huge about, is this whole idea that small is beautiful. And I'm like, small can be okay. But if we're talking about providing, you know, livelihoods, and we're talking about diversification and doing it in a way that we can actually meet the markets and sell to grocery stores, we're talking about scale. Like, this is not a little tiny 6-acre, you know, fun times thing. This is a full-time operation for lots of people. We're talking about big scale. We're talking about reasonably sized equipment. And if you're going to do multiple components, you can't just do a big grain operation and maybe a tiny dairy. They kind of all have to be roughly that same scale. So I guess that's kind of something. If there's anybody on the sustainable ag side listening, I would really recommend kind of not just thinking everything has to be small in order to be good. You can do things at scale that are employee owned, that are sustainable. For example, if you have better revenues because you have scale, that means you can do cover cropping better. You're making more money, so you can invest a little bit more in the condition of the land. And so scale is not a bad word. It doesn't have to be bad. I think you can actually do a lot of really good things as long as you've got enough people on board to do things right.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tony is with us in Athens. Tony, hi.
Hi, thanks for this conversation. I'm a family farmer up in Athens, Wisconsin, near Wausau. And I think the main reason that we need to continue to promote family-scale agriculture, and by that I mean where the family provides the majority of labor, even if it's not necessarily the reality, but we should promote it in terms of policy because of economic democracy, broad-based and independent decision-making, lots of people having access to the land and the access of agricultural land wealth. So that is spread out. That's why it's important, not because of a picture we have of our grandparents, but we need to keep the wealth of land broad. Also, environmentally, having a smaller scale farm is inherently less impactful than larger scale farms, even if it's mismanaged. So large farms can be mismanaged as well.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. Let's get to his first point first, Sarah. That's that Thomas Jefferson kind of idea of a democracy of small business people and small farmers.
Right. And I think that's absolutely a super important point, is that we need some economic democracy. We need to have normal people have access to land. And that's why I think family farming is actually not that great. You have to inherit land in order to do farming. If we're doing a family farming system, there's really no way in. You either have to be born into it or you have to marry into it. And that's not democratic, right? The other issue is, you know, like he mentioned, you know, economic democracy. I think that's why employee ownership for these larger operations and for these diversified operations is the way to go, is because people do need to be able to build wealth, not just work and work and work, but also be able to build wealth. And I think that employee ownership is a really key part of it. I would not want to see these operations just be owned by one person or one company and everyone else be wage workers for that exact reason. So I really appreciate that he brought up that that point is important. I absolutely agree.
Thanks for the call. We'll bring on one more caller. Dan is with us in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi. I worked in local agricultural history in the Kickapoo Valley in southwest Wisconsin for a year and a half. I was a big family farm advocate in the 80s. I had an article from the Wall Street Journal and another article from a corporate CEO. Both said that if the government would provide the same level of support for small to mid-sized family farms as they did for big corporate farms, the smaller farms would be viable.
Dan, thanks for the call. Sarah, what do you think?
I would suggest going into Farm Service Agency documentation. So the Farm Service Agency is something the government set up back in 1916 to make sure that farms actually had good access to credit, right? Because prior to this, they really didn't. And if you go and you look into that, most of the farms they're getting loans to are mid-sized family farms. I think they're in the, it was the $1 million to, I would have to double check this, but it's the mid-sized farms. It's not the biggest operations. I want to send you this document, right? But the biggest operations are a pretty small slice of the operations that are getting the money. The ones that are getting the money are the mid-sized family farms. If you look at the total number of dollars, yes, it looks like the big operations are getting the most. But if you look at the number of operations getting loans, it's the mid-sized family farms that are getting the most support here. So that's certainly a popular take that I've heard a lot. But every time I go into the documentation, it doesn't quite add up if you actually look at the records. So I just don't really know what to make of that other than, yes, I'm certain that's how it feels when you're in it trying to get a loan. As a business owner, I've had a lot of those encounters myself. It's very challenging. It's very difficult. But if you look at the numbers, it tells a very different story.
Sarah, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That's Sarah Tabor. She's worked in agriculture, food, and manufacturing for over 20 years, has a doctorate in plant medicine from the University of Florida. She's the producer and host of the Farm to Tabor, that's T-A-B-E-R, podcast. We talked to her about her New York Magazine article titled America Loves the Idea of Family Farms. That's unfortunate. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.